Hello, I'm Keith Powell, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. The chair of Transparency International in Papua New Guinea says the lack of accountability for police opening fire on protesting students last week was disgraceful. Last Wednesday, police injured as many as 23 students from the University of PNG in Port Moresby after they tried to march to Parliament in a show of support for a planned vote of no confidence against Prime Minister Peter O'Neill. Mr. O'Neill, the police commissioner, Gary Backey, and the university's vice chancellor has sought to deflect the blame onto the students, who they say aggravated the situation through their actions. But Lauren Stevens told Jamie Tahanaha that regardless of their actions, there is no excuse for the police behavior.
We find it totally, despicably unacceptable that police would be armed confronting students at the university. It almost seemed to be a deliberate provocation of the students, and there seems to have been no excuse for them opening fire and mistreating a number of people, including in one case a journalist covering the event. Our position remains the same. The police have no right to behave in that manner, and people really should be controlling the use of weapons by our disciplined forces. They continue to cause us great shame and great destruction of life and damage to individuals.
We've seen Commissioner Gary Backey, who at some point promised to crack down on command and control in the force, but the Prime Minister, the University Chancellor, all in a sense put blame on the students. Inquiries have been announced into how this violence happened, but yet there seems to have been no actual condemnation of the police from authorities.
That appears to be the case. It seems to be much easier to blame, for example, foreign media for reporting rumours of death having, you know, been an issue, when the real issue is not the rumours of death, but the fact that the police opened fire. And no, that is not being focused on as it should be focused on. And it's pretty awful when people suggest that students exercising their constitutional right to stage a protest, to make public their concerns, are confronted with murderous weapons and attacks.
There are countless examples of such brutality. We had Hanuabada last year. We've had the clashes with the army and such. Are they acting with a sense of impunity as a government as well?
I'd say that's very, very true. Our problem is that people do act as if they have impunity, and they do so justifiably, because you very rarely find that anybody is seriously held accountable. You don't, for example, see police commissioners resigning, having failed to control their police officers and having been ultimately responsible for the loss of lives. You don't find them taking that responsibility and stepping aside on the basis that they've failed. You don't find any of our political office holders prepared to take responsibility for the decisions that they are ultimately responsible for, but look for other people to blame.
The president of the Student Representative Council at the University of Papua New Guinea says he is trying to maintain calm around the student body after last week's unrest at the university's Wagani campus. However, Kenneth Rapa says that it's up to the government to respond to outrage in communities around PNG over police opening fire on students after they tried to march to Parliament to support a planned vote of no confidence against the Prime Minister, Peter O'Neill. Dozens of students were reported to have been hospitalized with injuries, including at least four in critical condition. Mr. Rapa told Johnny Blades that in the wake of the shootings, most of the students are staying away from campus.
Because they found that the police can go right into the campus and shoot them, it's unsafe for them to stay in the campus anymore. So, I mean, most of the students have left the campus already.
Police are still on the campus, I understand, is that right? Still patrolling?
Yes, they are still patrolling, and we don't know why.
And yet the university wants the main student body to return to class. What's your response?
After what has happened, the administration and the council is, I don't know if they have been controlled or the decision that they are making is from them, or because of after what has happened on Wednesday, how could you expect the students to go back? Because right after they have been traumatized, and some students have been hospitalized, and, you know, and that court order that they took to stop the protest too. So now it's up to the students to decide on what will happen, because the admin, the student administration, student or university administration, just took a court order against the SRC to stop the students from boycotting classes and protesting. So
what happened on Wednesday has brought it to a new level, but you know that some people in the community will be angry, and how do you control that? How can you keep everyone calm at this time?
Yes. You know, PNG, when it gets out of hand, the people don't listen anymore. So what I'm trying to do is I'm only trying to control my students and telling them that what happened on Wednesday was not planned, and it was an unfortunate event. So what we're trying to do is we're only trying to calm our parents and our families, but that doesn't mean we will control the entire bulk of the population, which is 8 million. And some people, they are beyond our reach, you know. So some things they are doing, it's uncontrollable, because even like the most media that we are using is Facebook and TV1, which is only centered around the nation's capital and only the few urban centers. Not most part of PNG, the media is not reaching them. So some parts where we are not able to reach, just, things are going worse and worse each day. So it's up to the government to decide what's going to happen next for this country, because now it's really getting out of hand at this time.
A healthcare provider in PNG says the number of people living with HIV is stable, but there is still a lack of education on the virus. Appropriate Technology, or AT, projects helps people in the Highlands access treatment for the virus and receive adequate health care to deal with AIDS. AT Projects co-director Steve Layton told Lucy Smith about the problems faced by people living with HIV and AIDS in rural areas.
Further you go out into the rural areas of the country, then yes, people don't necessarily understand what HIV/AIDS is. You know, there's been a hell of a lot of awareness in PNG, and the assumption is that everybody now knows what HIV is. But I don't think that's really true. A lot of people will have a very good idea, and some people will have quite a vague idea of what HIV/AIDS is.
I was speaking to Steve Krause, who's from the UN AIDS program in the Pacific and Asia. And he was saying that in Papua New Guinea that the numbers are falling. Do you think that numbers are falling?
Personally, I don't believe that. I don't necessarily believe that they are climbing. I think that's very difficult to prove that. And no one in PNG really has those sort of statistics. It's all based on people's perception out in the field. And our perception has to be that maybe, just maybe, it's stabilizing. But you know, we know, for example, the number of people being tested is greatly reduced now. Last year there was a big budget cut, and the funding for testing was not the same.
What do you think is the main reason for HIV/AIDS still being an issue in Papua New Guinea?
What you have here is quite a promiscuous society. So if you have a village dance, which are quite common, in the Highlands they're called 6 to 6, because you literally start dancing at 6 o'clock and go on to 6 o'clock the next morning. There is alcohol, there is marijuana, and I think that, you know, if a young woman, for example, was to say to a man, come on, let's go and have sex behind the 6 to 6 stand, then I don't think young men think twice. You know, they're not thinking about, well, does this woman have HIV/AIDS? And I think we have quite a promiscuous society. You know, the churches are trying to convince people to, you know, either have safe sex or not sex at all. But I don't think that message is getting across. That's my experience.
Is it an issue of a lack of funding to be able to support initiatives that would educate people?
It still takes a very long time for people to come to those centres and say, look, I've got a problem here. I think I need some assistance. And then our volunteers will take them off to get tested. Last year, because of the big change in Australian aid, we were fully funded for about 5 years, 6 years. Last year, with the changes that went on, we received a 50% budget cut. So we went from 10 centres to 7. We were able to do some cost savings and invest some of our own money. But we went from 10 to 7. We're being told that next year it's highly unlikely we're going to get any funding at all. So clearly there's a lack of overall funding for these programs. And the national government is not in a position to pick them up. So I'm not quite clear what we're going to do next year. We'll be looking for other funders. Whether we get them or not, I don't know. And the dilemma for us is if we don't get those funding, not only can we not support the 50-plus volunteers, but we're going to have 230 people with full-blown AIDS with nowhere to go.
The Prime Minister of New Zealand, John Key, made a 24-hour visit to Fiji this week, the first by a New Zealand leader in a decade. Mr. Key hopes for the progress on issues such as the Pacer Plus trade deal and Fiji's absence from the Pacific Island forums. But it was not all plain sailing. Sally Rown accompanied the Prime Minister and filed this report.
Nyala Village, Mr. Key's last stop in a heavily symbolic trip aimed at resetting relations between the two countries.
The other thing you probably know is that our rugby team's called the All Blacks and they're the world champions. And tomorrow night we're playing Wales and you guys are going to play Tonga, right? You going to win?
Yes.
I can't hear you. You going to win?
Yes.
I can't hear you. You going to win?
Fiji's Prime Minister Frank Bainimarama wasn't so keen to please at the banquet in honour of Mr. Key. He used his welcome speech to justify his coup and lash out at the New Zealand media.
There appears to be a substantial body of opinion in New Zealand, led by a generally hostile media, that what has happened in Fiji somehow lacks legitimacy, that somehow I lack legitimacy and my government lacks legitimacy. This is simply not borne out by the facts.
And Mr. Bainimarama made it clear he wouldn't lift a ban on blacklisted journalists, including some from New Zealand, one of the sticky matters Mr. Key had come to talk about. The Fijian leader's words at a state occasion appalled the opposition camp. The opposition leader, Rotimi Mukepa, said so in her meeting with Mr. Key.
I apologised to him because I believe it was inappropriate. It was something that you would not bring up at a state banquet. New Zealand is trying its best, and we are grateful.
But both prime ministers insisted they were keen to progress the relationship following the coup years, Mr. Key later brushing off talk of a snub.
Now, I wasn't surprised that he made the comments that he made. He's made those comments before, and he'll probably make them again, and he feels very strongly about the actions he took. New Zealand doesn't resolve from the steps that we took, because at the core of it, New Zealand cherishes and believes very strongly in democracy.
Had earlier pulled out all stops to welcome Mr. Key with a 100-strong guard of honour, children lining the streets with flags and a massive roadside billboard featuring the New Zealand leader. All a far cry from the unceremonious departure in 2007 of the New Zealand High Commissioner Michael Green, declared persona non grata at the height of post-coup bad blood between the two countries. Mr. Key called on the Fijian President Georgi Konrote before official talks between the two delegations, described by Mr. Bainimarama as fruitful.
And we have begun the process of rebuilding and redefining our relationship, and we have a much better understanding of our respective positions.
But Mr. Key was not able to pull off his plan to get Mr. Bainimarama to return to the leaders' table at the Pacific Islands Forum. Mr. Bainimarama has refused to attend since Fiji's post-coup suspension was lifted, saying Australia and New Zealand have too much influence. Mr. Key told Mr. Bainimarama the forum relies on the leadership shown by Australia and New Zealand.
New Zealand's not going anywhere. We have significant responsibilities across the Pacific, and we take those responsibilities very seriously. And the Pacific Forum is the architecture we use for that.
It was an agree to disagree on the journalists' blacklist too. But Mr. Key says there was progress on things like the seasonal work scheme and the region's Pacer Plus trade deal.
I think it's been very successful. I mean, the aim of this visit was really to reset the relationship, put the last sort of, 8 years of the military coup behind us, but really to say, look, we're now on a new foundation stone.
I'm not entirely sure I want to tackle any Tongans in this tomorrow, but, you know, but thank you for the thought anyway.
Manaka,
thank you very much.
The two leaders exchanged parting gifts of rugby paraphernalia. In a heavily symbolic visit to finally end a decade of tension, it was at least a win for rugby diplomacy. In Fiji, Sally Round.
A new traffic system is being tried at the main wharf in Vanuatu's capital to help ease tensions over access to cruise ship passengers. In March, disagreements between public transportation providers and tour operators saw several altercations at the Port Vila wharf, including an incident where stones were thrown at a tour bus. The vice president of Vanuatu's Cruise Tourism Association says the two-month trial, which began 2 weeks ago, has so far been well received. John Tanner spoke to Corey Hawkins about the new system,
which involves the relocation of market vendors, a dribble feed and flow system for land transport, compliance with some of the water transport, the water taxis, and it sort of the shore tours or the ship book tours, independent tours. There are a lot of players that all had to operate within a small facility and to make sure that we had safe and compliant operations. So in a lot of ways, it was turning a square wheel into a round wheel so that we could get things flowing smoothly.
Right. And this 60-day trial, what happens at the end of that?
So we have, at the start of the trial, three of the ministers supported the program, and they were the ministers who the infrastructure is within their jurisdiction. There's the Minister for Public Works, the Deputy Prime Minister, who's also the Minister for Tourism, and the Minister for Internal Affairs. So the traffic management plan, it's an all-encompassing plan, as I've said, and after the 60-day trial, the goal is to have actually a workable traffic management system that can then be put into effect and made as a permanent procedure for all those industries and stakeholders to follow. So this 60 days is done to iron all the creases out of the sheet and enable the government to put into place an enforceable traffic management for the longer term.
Now, I understand you're getting positive response from most stakeholders on this?
Oh, look, just to be really blunt, we've had now four cruise ships that have come through the traffic management plan, and every port call or every visit of a ship has improved in how the plan has been managed. And those of us who are behind the structure and implementation, we haven't reached where we need to be or where we would happy to be, but we're very, very happy to say that all the ships so far has had a positive progression of the product or the traffic management. And by far, the majority of feedback has been extremely positive. I think it's impossible to have 100% of feedback positive from the start of a trial. And there are a few who are raising issues. We've got a public awareness campaign which will be held tomorrow at the new convention centre up near Parliament House at 10 o'clock. And the public awareness is basically to let those that aren't direct stakeholders in the wharf get informed as to what's happening, because there are a lot of indirect industries who are impacted by how the wharf is managed and how the traffic does flow, including surrounding residents, other related or fringe businesses with tourism just off the wharf. So we want to get everyone up to the convention centre tomorrow at 10 o'clock and put a big visual presentation on what has happened, where the traffic management 60-day trial goalposts are, and then give them a little bit of a future vision to where we need to be heading. In a lot of ways, some of the positive comments, a simple thing is, this is how traffic management should be heading. It's sort of a little bit of a reflection, I guess, of how far off track we were or how much the update and the structure of traffic management was desperately needed. But we definitely now have things heading in the right direction, and it's a continuous improvement policy.
And looking to the future longer term, I understand there's other wharf developments that are hoping to ease the pressure on the main wharf?
It's been a long road unrelated to this, but and that is the development of Lapitasi Wharf. Now, Lapitasi Wharf is a project from the local stevedores and Vanuatu government with the assistance of JICA. It's a $90 million wharf development, and it'll be an international container wharf specifically designed for container operations. So at the moment, we have a smaller wharf which is shared by container and cruise operations. So the development of this wharf, which should be completed around about September next year, will give us a container wharf, and it'll also give us a cruise wharf or a tourism wharf. So it'll definitely bolster the our marine capacity. And with that, that's why we really push now to start developing a traffic management plan, so that when that wharf is finished, we've got a horse that's already running, rather than trying to whip the stable pony. We want to really be up and running and keep up, because the growth in cruise tourism in Vanuatu and in the South Pacific has been pretty radical over the last 4 to 5 years, and it shows very strong signs of continuing, certainly in the immediate future. So some of these structures are both to keep up today and also to plan for what's ahead.
The Cook Islands Opposition Coalition has dismissed government claims that it has been delivering sound, disciplined financial management. It says they can't judge because the government's accountants haven't been able to audit for the past 3 years. The opposition's finance spokesman, James Baer, told Don Wiseman this is highly irresponsible.
What concerns us is that we're debating things, but it may be irrelevant because those documents, those very important Crown accounts, have not been audited by the audit department.
So the government, of course, is saying that everything's looking hunky-dory. What makes you think it isn't?
Well, the government likes to say that, and we know it isn't, because we've got anecdotal evidence from a number of business people and a number of people on the island, one of them is myself, that the economy is definitely slipping. But what really compounds that situation is that we've seen the current tax revenue the country is receiving, and we've had an increase in VAT amounts. A bill was passed in 2012 to increase VAT by an extra 2.5%, and at the same time be able to get more revenue. What's really interesting about this certain development is that revenue collection, which was estimated to come in excess of about $8 million over the current revenue that we're collecting, hasn't occurred. The same VAT amounts are beginning to show up year after year, despite the fact that we've increased VAT. So the delivery of a VAT increase has not given the government what it had thought it would get. But as a result of proposing this increase, they've gone out there and expended more money in terms of welfare and benefits to old age pensioners and children. And that really hasn't been taken care of, because the VAT increase that they thought they would get did not eventuate. And the reason for that, of course, is because what they didn't realise is that a number of issues were raised to them over the potential increase in cost of goods and services that would force more and more people to leave. And what has been happening is that a whole bunch of Cook Islanders are beginning to find the cost of living, particularly in the Outer Island, has gone up exponentially, not by 2.5%, but by a lot more as a result of the 2.5% VAT increase. So as a result of that, it's become harder and harder for Outer Islanders, particularly in the Northern Group, where there's a lot of isolation and distance to travel and transportation, becoming harder and harder for them to leave. So as a result of that, we've had more and more Cook Islanders jumping on a plane and departing the shores for New Zealand and Australia.
And it's purely that's really dragging the economy down.
Yes, we've got a whole bunch of stuff. What we're really concerned about is that we've got documents or Crown accounts that haven't been audited for now going on 4 years. So the last one that came to Parliament was for the 2012 period. You know, any aid agency, any donor agency, which the Cook Islands government, unfortunately, the country relies on so much, should be concerned that the relevancy of those documentation and it being audited and coming to Parliament for oversight and transparency has not existed for the last 4 years. So when the government says we're doing a great job in managing the country's affair, our position is it is not. How do we know that when we haven't had transparency over this issue or oversight by Parliament?
And finally on the program, a report that just came in on the stories that we actually covered at the beginning of the program on the student unrest in Papua New Guinea. The police shootings at the University of Papua New Guinea in Port Moresby last week have complicated efforts as the territorial institutions to get students back to class. Clashes at the University of Technology in Lae on Monday left one person in the hospital after a fight between students streaming from a forum to discuss whether to continue to the boycott of classes, which has actually been in place since May. Later in the day, that involved clashes, and many others actually agreed to stop it. However, there's now unrest at the University of Gokura in the Eastern Highlands. Johnny Blades speaks next to Albert Sherem.
You know, I understand it as an emotional reaction to the events last week in Port Moresby, which we strongly condemn. However, I think sanity should prevail, and they can win both their academic year as well as continue their fight as they see it.
They obviously see the boycott as part of that fight. For better or worse, yeah. They think that's effective, but you don't feel that it will be?
We have had a feeling that after they have done awareness, that is really, you know, their achievement to make this issue known and make it understood by the larger public in Papua New Guinea, you know, most of whom are subsistence farmers and many of whom, unfortunately, are illiterate. So they rely on the information given to them by their the students to form their opinion. So that has really been their role. And at this point, it's a national issue regarding the respect for the constitution and the management of the economy. And the solution should really be found in parliament and not on the campuses.
How much longer can you hold on without the students, the main student body, returning to class before it becomes unviable to the school year?
We're coming in a critical phase now where we seriously have to see whether we need to extend the duration of the academic year. So we have a signed agreement by the Student Representative Council and all the associations that they would return to classes today. But because of the incident last week in Port Moresby, the dynamic, they changed somewhat. We do, however, believe that there is a large group of students who understand and have had enough now of the boycott and want to go back to classes. So we hope sanity will prevail.
So come today, you didn't really have most of the students back at class, is that right?
No, and yesterday we had this this brawl after the forum, so that didn't help either. So we are seeing a very slow start this week, but we do hope that next week we can start full speed ahead.
With the brawl yesterday, there are reports that Southern Highlands students, or at least students from one or two Highlands provinces, are split away from the main student body on the issue of the boycotts.
Yeah, there is disagreement within the student body, but I don't accept to call it an ethnic or a provincial conflict. It is more complex than that. The students here, you know, they're just mates, and when they fall out, they tend to group in provincial groups, but it's not that deeply felt. So we just had the reconciliation, and they spoke very maturely, and they promised to not to retaliate, and usually that type of agreements they hold.
And we will also have more on the situation in Papua New Guinea as it develops, so stay tuned to Focus Asia Pacific. Anyway, with that, we've come to the end of the program. If you want to contact us, our email address is very simple. It's focus@pcjmedia.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well, saying so long, take care. We'll see you again very soon. Bye-bye.